laboriously delicious hello to you from sunny Hungary, where the action never stops, even as we change ourselves and considering how hot is going to be today. It's only 8 o'clock and it's already pretty much in the high 20s, that's in Celsius. Considering how hot it's going to be today, well, there's a good chance I have to change my socks a couple of times today, because, well, for obvious reasons. Well, and this is Tom, and today I'm coming at you with the June 2012 issue of Tomicide Solutions, fiendishly entitled, Who is in Charge of Your Business Development? Do you know that over the last few decades, Eon and the Broccoli Brothers have thought pretty seriously about who should play James Bond? Considering Bond's accumulated fame and notoriety, that was a serious question. The wrong choice would ruin the whole 007 enterprise, basically. Ian Fleming originally wanted David Niven, but he was dropped. Then Fleming suggested his own cousin, Christopher Lee, but that was considered a conflict of interest. Also, by that time, Christopher Lee, through his own choice, was on his path of becoming the ultimate villain, the ultimate bad person. He just made up his mind once upon a time that he was going to play only the anti-heroes, the bad people in movies, which he did. Then, Patrick McGoohan turned the opportunity down because he thought Bond was too promiscuous for his character. So did Gerard Butler because he thought it would ruin his career. Then came Rod Taylor, but he considered the role to be beneath him. The interesting thing is that then even the name Rod Taylor has just vanished. Nowadays, nobody even knows who he is. Then, Burt Reynolds and Clint Eastwood were offered the role, but they turned it down because they thought it should be a British actor to play James Bond, and that was a fair comment. At one point, even veteran singer Tom Jones was considered, and then came Daniel Craig, and the producer crew settled with him. So it's not easy to decide whom to put in such an important position. And it can be equally important to decide whom to put in charge of your IT company's business development. Should it be a sales-savvy person or a marketing-savvy person? This is the dilemma I had with Eric, a client a few months ago. His company had always been a hunter in terms of client acquisition, but Eric realized that the hunter approach was dying out. But they had never done marketing, per se, so it was natural to appoint the fiercely competitive sales manager to run business development, that is, integrating sales and marketing. And then the problems started. Well, a bit later, but more or less then. Liz, the new business development director's idea was that marketing was for wimps who were too lazy and too stupid to sell. Based on that, she presented her quote-unquote manifesto to the board, emphasizing that based on those principles, she intended to shake up the company. Which, well, she did in a way. Since I think there are some lessons in her manifesto, I've decided to share those lessons with you. So, let's see, we may come up with some lessons that are worth paying attention to. Many of her manifesto items were based on the old McKinsey fallacy. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. This so-called truism has been refuted many times, but some people still live by that nonsense. So Liz's first manifesto item was this idea that sales is a numbers game. Many years ago, when I was studying for my horse and cart driving license in England in order to drive a horse-drawn hearse, at the time I was still in the funeral industry. I was a grave digger, and then I branched out into coffin making, embalming, and then had the idea that, hey, I should get a license to drive a horse-drawn hearse. And then, as I was practicing for my test, I realized that it doesn't matter how much faster I'm whipping the horses, the cart is not going to progress equally faster. So just because I double the rate of whipping the horses, it's not going to double the speed of the cart. Optimum speed is achieved by selecting horses of the right character and properly maintaining the cart. Both have measurable elements, but at the end of the day, both the horses and the cart require the judgment and discernment. Measurement alone is not enough. Cold calling is retarded practice to acquire clients, and no matter how many calls we make, we can never reach the cream, the top 0.5 to 2% of the market. That's a sort of premium segment of the market. And these are the clients who would make the best clients, who are willing to pay premium fees for our solutions. Clients that pay fully and promptly, and they have the best potential for repeat and referral business. But if we look at sales as a numbers game and start dialing for dollars and knocking on doors and just increasing the numbers, we can't reach them. So instead of looking at the numbers game, which is the quantity game, we have to look at the quality game, and we have to hand select companies, hand select businesses which we want to reach, businesses with which we want to initiate relationships, and see whether or not there's a mutually beneficial beneficial basis to do business together. So it's not about chasing, but carefully cherry picking. The next point was in Liz's manifesto was that focus on your numbers and you will succeed. In a way, this is an extension of the numbers game. This is, in a way, similar to the nonsense promoted in the movie, The Secret. If you think of what you want, it will fall into your lap. And what they promote, and that made The Secret a big marketing ploy for the largest target market on the face of the planet, success-hungry losers. If you just sit there visualizing, meditating, praying, whatever you want will fall from the sky straight into your lap. Well, the problem is if you wish a big car and that falls into your lap, then you are in deep trouble. But that can happen. Well, that can't happen anyway. The interesting thing is that clients can feel what salespeople focus on. Most salespeople focus on their own quotas and commissions. That is, what's in it for them. As a result, quite correctly, most clients don't trust them. But this is not salespeople's fault, far from it. Most IT companies pay their salespeople for short-term individual performance. That achieves two things. Most salespeople resent long-term profitability and teamwork. They're two main criteria for lasting success. Now, I know many people spit on teamwork, saying that no, it's all about individual performance, but they spit on teamwork because they don't understand teamwork. So, of course, if we don't know something, we are skeptical about it. That's natural human character. Anyway, buyers are not idiots, and they know that due to the retarded compensation system, salespeople focus on their own success and don't really give a shit about their client's success. But if you want to lose weight, what should you focus on? On the number of pounds to lose, the end, or your training, nutrition, and lifestyle, means to the end. The good thing is that you can control the means, but you can't control the end. And the good thing is, equally good thing is, if you fulfill the means, you are almost guaranteed to lose the desired weight, that is, to achieve the end. So if salespeople focused on their client's success, they would be more trusted, more respected, and they would make more sales. It's that simple. Why is this so hard to understand? Well, I don't know. I really don't know. If business sales managers understood this dynamic, then they would have already scrapped the retarded compensation structure, the commission structure. The next point was, excellent salespeople are born. Well, so are excellent dodo trainers, disco singers, and turntable mechanics. The problem is that they are gone by the way of what we can only call, in plain English, the dodo bird. Since the birth of those salespeople, both the sales terrain and the overall buy-sell dynamic has changed quite a bit. So whatever excellence those salespeople were born with is just a temporary measure. Life goes on and the world changes. And every change requires a different behavior both from buyers and sellers. And now we are at sales education as a never-ending practice. And at that moment, all genetic knowledge of the born salesman or salesperson, I would say, is pretty useless because there are new skills to learn. And one more thing, since we are here, what skills salespeople actually need to sell complex, high-ticket, and hard-to-explain solutions to sophisticated buyers? Not sales skills, that's certain. Not the traditional nonsense of persuade, convince, present, handle objection, and close, basically bludgeoning clients over the head. No, what they need is general boardroom caliber business savvy, understanding the prospect's business and the industry, and kick-ass diagnostic skills. And all that can be learned and practiced almost to perfection. So whether or not that person is so-called born to be an excellent salesperson, well, maybe not. I don't think so. But that's subject to individual taste. So some people believe great salespeople are born. I believe no, they are not. They get educated to be educated and practiced to be excellent. The next point is have a great elevator pitch. Good point. Now, my question is, but what the bloody hell for? This is what people call a unique selling proposition, USP, that is, what differentiates you from the competition. It's nice, but without explicit problems and needs to solve, the USP is useless. It's far too early to trumpet what makes you a different and better husband than your girlfriend's five other lovers, if she has no intention to marry at all. If you are a Duda's, just reverse the roles. The other problem is that most people with whom you can use your elevator pitch are not real decision makers, but lower level opinion makers, basically flunkies. After telling them what you do, they go to their bosses and make a pig's ear of trying to represent your business. And from then on, you are dead and buried because the presentation will be dull with all the uniqueness missing, and the big boss will nod, Well, we've already got that covered. We don't need that. So, hint, real buyers hardly ever go to places where there is a danger of low-flying elevator pitches. The places they go to have a better chance of having some low-flying flyers, flying saucers, but not elevator pitches. So, what to say when asked what do? I think the least phony answer is that something like the best way to explain it is by telling you a short story about one of my clients. And consider this, the reptilian brain, the ultimate decision maker in the human body, can relate to stories, but cannot relate to abstract descriptions, provided the stories consist of the six ingredients the reptilian brain needs to make these decisions. So just stay with the story, and you'll be all right. You don't come across as a salesperson. You come across more like an enthusiastic professional. Next point, run a proposal factory. Most meetings of most salespeople end in salespeople's volunteering to submit elaborate proposals, which often escalate to the level of the proverbial war and peace, full of useless self-aggrandizement and implementation minutiae. I've read somewhere that the average proposal for a high five or low six-figure project takes about 143 person hours. This is almost a full month's work of people who are on six-figure annual salaries. So sellers are now in heavy-duty proposal production mode, although the only reason buyers agreed to the submission of their proposals is just to get rid of these salespeople. Now imagine that those super busy executives or procurement agents get on with their works and one day a proposal shows up. What happens? Nothing. Not a sausage. In the best case, they throw it away, but in the worst case, they start cherry-picking the best ideas for internal implementation. Look at the proposal as marriage proposals. When men propose to women, when there's a 99% chance of getting a resounding yes, they know when the timing is right. They know when to propose. So if we take this romantic proposal idea into the business proposal context, and salespeople have to know their timing, when is the right time to propose. Some buyers may say, submit a proposal and then we can talk. In most cases, it's just a covert way of getting rid of you. Make sure your buyers jump through some qualifying hoops before you submit proposals to them. Also, keep your proposals short and strategic, strictly big picture. It must be a written documentation of what you've already verbally agreed to. You can also consider charging a nominal fee for your proposal. Then, on acceptance, you credit this fee back to the client on the project fee. But when you charge for it, even a nominal amount, and the client pays for it, that's a level of commitment. So that may be worth considering. Next point was, unless you're a born salesperson, it takes years to become one, to become a good salesperson. Well, not so much in terms of years, but what sort of practice you pack into your years. Practicing handling objections and closing is useless no matter how long you do it. Only peddlers and hucksters do that, and buyers do their best to avoid them like the plague. Using obsolete techniques, it can really take many years to learn something useful and to become a profitable salesperson. Note, profitable. The key is not to make dozens of sales at 30 to 50% discount, but to make a few sales, and in those sales to capture the value to be created for clients and get paid for that value and the delivery of that value. Drastically different approaches. Unfortunately, obsolete sales tricks get salespeople relegated to purchasing agents, and then the price war starts. And regardless of the demanded discount, most salespeople are simply unable to walk away from shitty deals. Sadly, but realistically. So they happily accept deals that walk their companies one large step closer to the bankruptcy court. Also, they accept shitty deals because they know, yes, this is a crappy client, but after signing on the bottom line, I don't have to deal with these clients. It's the guys back in the company who have to deal with these idiots. That's another problem. Yeah, the other point is all we need is just to get face-to-face with buyers. The idea here is that once salespeople are in front of buyers, they can manipulate them or even twist their arms to hand over the money. This is why many sales trainers still teach that first salespeople have to sell appointments, and once with buyers, they can push and cajole buyers to do something and, well, hand over some money. Well, this approach doesn't work anymore, in my opinion, simply because instead of buyers meeting salespeople, buyers instruct purchasing agents to organize bidding wars and see who is willing to do the job cheaper. We can say that in response to retarded, pushy and manipulative selling practices, buyers had created manipulative buying practices. And by today, it's become a full-blown pissing contest between buyers and sellers to out-trick and out-manipulating each other. But buyers have got fed up with the process, stepped back, and built strong peddler fodders around them called the purchasing and procurement departments. So to protect themselves from the barrage of commission-hungry peddlers and their idiotic sales managers. So sadly, sellers have got stuck outside their market's peddler fodders, speechlessly staring at the new situation, just staring out of their heads like a herd of urinating hogs, not knowing what to do. And after many years, they have started realizing that by attacking peddler fodders using old methods, all they achieve is that they collect more broken bones, bumps and bruises. They know they have to use more brain, not more brawn, to entice buyers out from behind their peddler fodders using valuable content and totally new sales approaches. Some sellers learn, most of them don't. As German physicist, the discoverer of quantum physics and the 1980 Nobel Prize winner Max Planck said many years ago, progress happens funeral by funeral. Tend to agree. Lots of peddlers and their sales managers have to die before selling in general becomes more buyer-friendly. Oh well, gravediggers need jobs too. I don't mean to be cynical. I'm merely expressing a little sympathy for my former profession. Long live the gravediggers. Next point, we are the best choice. This is something everyone and his kitchen sink claims. Especially marketers and copywriters are notorious for calling themselves America's best, the world's best, the world renowned. But IT companies stay close to with the unsubstantiated claims of robust, bleeding edge, world class, etc. Yes, in every industry there is a best choice, or rather seemingly best choice. Well, George W. Bush was the seemingly best choice for the US presidency in 2001, but turned out to be a disaster. And Bernie Madoff was the seemingly best choice, guarding people's money. After all, as the past president of NASDAQ, he really was the best bet to invest with. Was Bush of Madoff really the best choice? Well, based on a 2008 study by Broderick and Company, here is a breakdown on what buyers are looking for when they want to engage external professionals and find the best choice, basically. So, look at it, it's really interesting. The most important factor is experience in the client's industry. The second criterion, subject matter expertise. Third, understanding the client's business. Fourth, collaborative style and easy to work with. Factors like cost of service is at the bottom. Geographic location at the very bottom. So you can see how smart companies select external professionals and how losers select professionals. Winners select industrial expertise, losers select low price. Is it surprising that most winners remain winners and most losers remain losers? What makes a company a winner or loser? The leader's mindset. Well, what else? What makes the seller the best choice in buyer's eyes? Blair Warren explains it in his book, One Sentence Persuasion. Encourage their dreams, justify their failures, allay their fears, confirm their suspicions, and help them throw rocks at their enemies. It may seem simple, but he might be just right. I think he is. If you manage to demonstrate those 5 points, your company becomes the default best choice. And now, with that, unceremoniously, we have arrived to the summary. So, these were some points of Liz's manifesto about increasing sales. The good thing was that Eric, the big boss, saw the problem with her approach right away. The problem was that Liz's approach would have increased short-term gross revenue at the expense of long-term net profits. And Eric was smart enough to forego short-term revenue for long-term profits. And what happened to Liz, the new sales director? Well, based on her behavior after leaving the company, I think she became a ward in a prison. Her idea of threatening and intimidating her people to perform better made her the perfect choice for that job. And I think Eric learned it once and for all that business development in the 21st century was a far cry from hard sales in the 20th century. And doing hard sales in the 21st century was a recipe for disaster. Today, the company has an integrated business development team run by a marketing veteran with a pretty impressive track record. But what's even more important than her track record is her attitude about business development. It's about gently compelling buyers to do business with the company rather than mercilessly bludgeoning them with sales pitches like a pirate gang until buyers surrender and hand over their money. Yes, the sophisticated approach takes a bit more thinking and a bit more planning, but also creates better relationships with clients, and those clients are willing to pay for the value of their projects. And in my view, these two benefits alone make the second approach more viable in the long run. But the question is, what do you think? So that was Tomicide Solutions, July 2012. So we discussed who should be in charge of your business development. Hopefully you found some good points. and then you can implement some changes in your own company's business development. In the meantime, have a great month, week, weekend, and then we'll talk in July.